and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, with Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background. This is the 40th episode of the Consumer Podcast. This is the episode of September 9, 2021. It is September still, and just trying to remind you, as always, you can check us out on all the social media channels. Follow our podcast. There's also the Consumer Choice Radio Show with my colleagues Yala Sowski and David Clement. That's North America focused for the most. And you can also check out Consumer Choice Cast, which is our podcast where we upload all of our recent media hits, all the audio media hits that are available of the Consumer Choice Center. And also check out our newest reports and indexes on consumerchoicecenter.org. You can find that under the publications page. And lastly, of course, if you do support this podcast and our work, you can make a donation on the consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. I've got a great episode for you this week. My guest this week is Jan Moszowski. He is the director for research at Liberální Institute in the Czech Republic and a regional coordinator for Central Europe at Students for Liberty. He studied economics at the University of Edinburgh and is now a doctoral student at Charles University in Prague. We'll be talking about the Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš, his fight with the European Union, and what it means for Prague politics. Also in this episode, France has big demands for food imports and Sweden drops all restrictions for COVID at the end of the month. So let's get started. So France says that fair food import standards are their main objective during the EU presidency. So this is the French Minister for Agriculture, Mr. De Normandie, who is actually, you know, rather reasonable person in my view. He was incremental getting rid of, at least temporarily, of the neonicotinoid ban. That's an insecticide that is necessary in modern agriculture to be used. He was reasonable on that issue because he said, well, our beet farmers will basically not be able to produce at least the consumption level of France anymore, which means that they have to start importing. But then, of course, on this issue, he's very French and very much online what Mr. Macron believes when it comes to agricultural imports. France prides itself and having good food, and they expect the same from their importers. So I will not read this in a French accent voice, but he says, quote, I will have one priority subject during the French presidency. In fact, I will have three. Okay. The first one is reciprocity and trade standards, so-called mirror clauses. The second is reciprocity and trade standards, mirror clauses. And the third is reciprocity and trade standards, mirror clauses. So he thinks he's particularly funny in making it sound this way. But of course, mirror clauses are not fair. The European Union has very high trade standards already, and it really makes it hard for all the countries, the non-EU countries that try to export to the European Union with their agricultural products. You know, if you are an African country, most African countries have something called EBA, which is everything but arms. So that's a trade agreement that allows African countries to trade without tariffs. However, there's still two more trade barriers to their activities. One is food standards. So that's all the compliance costs that you have if you're a farmer and you're trying to export to the European Union. And then the other is, of course, the fact that we subsidize our farmers considerably to the extent that they are able to sell below market prices in certain developing nations. I'm not exactly sure how we are supposed to give certain countries the ability to rise up, to export, to trade freely if we constantly erect barriers. Of course, our farmers are hurt by many of the unreasonable agricultural regulations that we implement. And now we try to do the same for the people that we import from. So I think that the French are really doing protectionism in the Trump style without, you know, labeling it as the way that Trump would do it. Now, Trump would argue that we would have to implement these protectionist measures to protect our local industry. France does that too, but they find different ways of explaining it. And one of them is basically the inclusion of the European Green Deal with our trade policy. De Normandie, he also says, it's not us who are subjected to other standards in Europe. It's Europe who imposes them on others. And he added that he found it nonsensical that a trade deal like the one with South America's Mercosur bloc could be concluded without taking into account negative externalities such as deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. I know we've talked about this before. There's a lot of myths, including those propagated by the president of France about deforestation in the Amazon. And again, it's one of those examples where, you know, like it's very Eurocentric perspective where, you know, you fly over France and it's, you know, it's actually quite centralized. You know, there's not too many rural communities compared to other countries. And you look, you know, you fly over these countries and you just see agriculture. You know, we've gotten rid of most of our forests. And then we compare us to a country like Brazil and we say, well, you can't do the same. You know, the thing that we did that made us rich, please don't do that. Please don't trade with other countries because otherwise you might eventually rise to our level. And it is really unfair to take this perspective. It ultimately is up to consumers how they want to govern this. If consumers think that they don't want to buy anything from Central American or South American or African countries, then that is a choice they can make. There are labels of origin where they can choose from. And if you want to buy just made in the EU or even just made in France, then that is your choice. But yet that choice should not be imposed on others. We should have free trade in agricultural products and allow countries to grow and to grow their economies as a result of that trade. In other news then, Sweden is dropping all of its COVID-19 restrictions. The government has announced that by the end of the month, so by September 29th, virtually all remaining restrictions will be lifted. This includes restrictions on restaurants as well as attending public events. Private gatherings will not have any attendance limit, and Swedish Public Health Agency's recommendation that work should be performed remotely and will be withdrawn. So this move represents the stage 4 in Sweden's de-lockdownization, even though Sweden had no particularly strict rules when it comes to lockdowns. This really creates the first country that really gets out of virtually all COVID restrictions in the developed world. And then you compare that to Australia, where basically you have these quarantine camps where people have to be in quarantine for quite a while and they're not allowed to leave. It's virtually a prison. So and then if you compare the different infection and death numbers of Sweden to the rest of Europe, you don't really see a dramatic difference. And I think that is really, really interesting. From the perspective of just, you know, allowing patients and consumers to make individual choices and not having all these really cruel and sometimes even very nonsensical rules. I mean, I just remember when we had all these curfews. Curfews did absolutely nothing to prevent the spread of this virus. And I just, you know, I just really appreciate that there was a country that said, hey, we're going to go a different way. We're not going to allow ourselves to be bullied by any red lists or orange lists or green lists. And it's worked. And it also provided us with the argument about how to do things differently. Because if all European countries had ultimately done the same, then there would be no way of actually comparing different results. And of course, now, if you look at the European map on infection rates and you know, the overall dangerosity of going to these different countries, this is by the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC. You can check that out online on their Facebook page. I think it's on a weekly basis. They update the color-coded map. You can see Sweden being sort of in the darker red and sort of their neighbors being more in the orange section. But then in darker red, you also have Spain and Portugal and the south of France even being in darker red. So ultimately, it doesn't feel like there's much difference that countries can make on these overall restrictions. By the way, these maps are also very useful because depending on whether you're vaccinated or not, the rules can change based on this EU map. So it makes sense to compare them. For instance, if you're traveling from a green country, there's actually no real restrictions that apply to you as a traveler. So for instance, right now, if you're traveling from Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary is one of them. Slovakia is one of them. And I think also Romania for the most part. These are green. So if you're traveling currently from these countries, a lot of the other EU member states will actually not have you checked for COVID tests or vaccines and so on. So ultimately, I really enjoy the Swedish experiment, especially because it, you know, it just shows that different choices can be made in governments. But now let's move to the interview of this week. As I said before, my guest is Jan Moszowski, is Czech, and he's the director for research at Liberální Institute and regional coordinator for Central Europe at Students for Liberty. Studied at the University of Edinburgh, is now a doctoral student at Charles University in Prague. And yeah, so we're talking about the Czech Prime Minister, his apparently corrupt business dealings, and what it means for Czech politics. So take it away. All right, Jan, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. So we've been talking in the European Union about Mr. Babiš for quite a while. He's been in trouble, in and out of trouble, let's say, of different investigations and different politicians. There's been European Parliament resolutions. And I think to the extent that some people have actually kind of forgotten what happened. And so the rough outline is important for people to know what exactly happened here. It seems that the Prime Minister, in his capacity as a shareholder or owner of a company, misused EU funds. Can you just explain a bit what exactly is alleged that Mr. Babiš did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, thank you for having me. And yes, so the EU is not the only one who's been occupied by Mr. Babiš for a while, so it's hard to find a good place to start. But let's start by the moment that Mr. Babiš entered politics, which was in 2013 when he first became part of the government. He was elected, and he as the leader of the second strongest political party, and he became the Minister of Finance. And at the time, he was already the owner of the Agrofert conglomerate and one of the richest Czech citizens, and which was also further complicated by him purchasing one of the largest media houses in the country in 2013, in the same year that he was elected. So from the beginning, even though he campaigned on the platform of transparency and anti-corruption, the conflict of interest was already there. And this was further complicated by him or his businesses being to a large extent dependent on European subsidies, because he's mostly active in agriculture. Agrofert is an agricultural conglomerate, so it's closely connected to the agriculture subsidies. And yes, and apart from him being partly in charge of the allocation of the subsidies, as well as him being directly able to influence the public opinion through the media that he owns, there were other causes that sort of started the later on demonstrations and interests that people have taken in these causes. Because there were also instances of him directly not only being in conflict of interest, but also using subsidies or receiving subsidies in a way that wasn't completely legitimate. The most famous cause is the Čapí hnízdo, and it could be translated to English as Stork's Nest, which is a project that he received a subsidy for. For small and medium-sized businesses by using a sister organization or a smaller organization than Agrofert directly, which when it was revealed spiraled into a series of demonstrations and in the whole investigation that we are talking about now.
You mentioned protests. So how exactly has this played out for Mr. Babiš and his party in the Czech Republic? Because I remember big protests, especially in Prague, where he doesn't seem to be particularly popular. How has communication been in civil society groups, but also from the opposition? Is it that some political parties kind of keep backwards because they think about, you know, eventually they might still need ANO as a coalition partner, or has it really been an opposition front against the current government?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, coming back to the outline of this whole thing, the demonstration started, I believe, to a large extent in 2017 when the situation about Čapí Hnízdo was first talked about, and there was also the related cause of him allegedly kidnapping his own son to Crimea to cover this cause. So that's when the first demonstration started, and they actually forced him to resign as the Minister of Finance. But the same year later on, he was elected, this time as the leader of the leading party, so he became the Prime Minister. And since then, I guess you can say that the demonstration has been the regular order of things, and you can also say that that there is a sort of democratic united opposition against him. The demonstrations were not directly organized by any organization connected to the opposition parties, but the opposition parties, and some of them more than others, were directly involved as speakers or attendees at the demonstrations. The largest ones actually in Prague that you mentioned were participated in 2019 by some 250,000, almost 300,000 people. So these were the largest demonstrations we've had since the Velvet Revolutions in the country. And yes, I believe that before the pandemic, there was sort of a united front against him. And it seemed likely that he won't be elected again. But then the pandemic started in early 2020. And this was sort of pushed to the background, and there was more focused, or there is still more focused, on him as the prime minister managing the crisis.
Right, that makes sense. Indeed, the pandemic has had quite an effect politically on different governments. Now, when it comes to the EU's communication, do you think it actually plays a role in the Czech Republic? Is the way that the EU has communicated about this, does that fall on deaf ears? Does anyone care? In the Czech Republic, is it used as an argument? Like the European Union has criticized the way that Mr. Babiš operates in the Czech Republic, or is there really no effect in Prague and other cities?
I believe there is effect, and I believe especially the audit that concluded that he is indeed in conflict of interest, and that some of the subsidies were received illegitimately. Definitely had effect, and they spurred another round of demonstrations, and especially his reactions to them with the relevant ministers immediately denying any responsibility for the administration of the subsidies, and claiming that he was innocent, and that him being accused of conflict of interest is part of some larger agenda. And I believe there is still some effect lasting even after the pandemic, and him legitimately receiving the subsidies is still talked about. But I also think that he sort of moved to a different audience, and he's trying to, in the upcoming elections next month, he's trying to find a different electorate. So I don't think that the audience he's now speaking to is really listening to these arguments.
So what kind of audience is he now trying to cater towards for the upcoming election?
Yeah, I think because the opposition sort of united, the democratic opposition united into one larger, you can call it liberal coalition, and one larger, more conservative coalition, and they are sort of not together, but they are sort of part of the United Liberal Opposition against him, and there is, or Democratic Opposition against him. And seeing that, I believe that he chose to turn to more nationalistic, more anti-immigration, more anti-free trade voices. And yes, he suddenly started speaking out against these topics that don't seem to be at the moment on the relevant ones, but they seem to be working on the, let's say, less liberal, more nationalist, but maybe you can call it patriotic or alt-right parts of the population. And watching his preferences, it seems to be working to some extent.
And this is very interesting. In another podcast I'm doing, I recently talked to a member of the European Parliament, and we talked about the situation in Poland and Hungary. And this MEP said, look, you know, Poland and Hungary are a big problem, but that doesn't tell us anything much about the other Central European countries. If you look at the Czech Republic doesn't really have the same problems in any sort of way. Now, what you're indicating there is that, yeah, well, maybe at this point the Czech Republic is not comparable, but is it, in your view, on the trajectory where the prime minister could increasingly become a Viktor Orban style figure?
I think it's hard to judge. I think for a while we've been aiming in a direction in the way that as the liberal voices, or let maybe the pro free trade, or maybe pro-European voices get stronger, the conservative or nationalist voices also get more radical. So I believe we can watch some inclination in direction. And maybe the best example of that was the quota on domestic produce that was approved by the Czech Parliament and later scrapped by the Senate. But it was pushed through partly with help of Andrej Babiš's party. And I think this is a good indication of what we might expect, as is his new book, which he published as part of the campaign, that speaks very strongly on the topic of the traditional family and these topics, anti-immigration topic. Actually starts by how Andrej Babiš saved the country from mass immigration. So yeah, I believe he is sort of moving in this direction to capture the voices that right now are inclined to vote for the minor nationalist parties, because I don't think he expects that he can get much more support from, or that he can draw much voters away from the democratic parties.
Now, from an information perspective, living in the Czech Republic is interesting, because if you're not an English speaker, your choices are, of course, Czech only news, and Mr. Babiš, of course, being involved in his own media ventures. Young people in the Czech Republic, where do young people get their news, in the assurance of the fact that they're not listening to a radio station or reading a newspaper that might be owned by the people they're writing about? How do young people go about that?
I think there are definitely still some platforms that are able of some quality independent journalism, but I think maybe the key lies in listening to a plurality of sources, not focusing on a particular medium, but trying to fact check the information from a number of sources. And yeah, that's probably it.
One last question I had for you before I let you go is, what do you think is, likely to happen? We don't really have like a way to predict the future and anything, but if there were eventually a procedure by the European Union to try and sanction the Czech Republic as a result of the actions of the Prime Minister, do you think that would help, or could that just embolden the current government and embolden their supporters? Does the European Union have leverage, is basically the question. Is there a way for the EU to intervene and improve the situation?
I think this is curious, because despite Andrej Babiš being dependent with his companies on the EU resources, his voters are very mostly anti-European or Eurosceptic. So I think if something like that happened, they would probably just double down and strengthen their support for Andrej Babiš. So I think it would definitely weaken his position economically, even though probably not politically. And yes, I think that there is a mechanism even now, because the EU refuses at this point to provide his companies with any more subsidies. But I don't believe that unless there is really an enforceable decision made on the Czech part, that he's going to return any of the, or that his companies are going to return any of the subsidies that they already received, or that he is likely to give up his companies altogether.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Jan Mošovský at Jan Mošovský on Twitter, and of course follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday.